One of the things that's hiding in plain sight, I submit, is that we live in an environment of a superabundance of opportunities. I grew up in a time when there was a certain number of options before me, and I could choose A, B, or C, or maybe D. Now, it's factored that by 1,000. We have more options than we can possibly imagine. So how do we navigate all these good options? And so I'm about to introduce one way of navigating myriad possibilities. And it is a counterbalance, an alternative to what I might call career planning and strategic planning. And I'm going to need a volunteer. And so, Marcus, would you join me? So Marco, my friend from Alameda, I'm going to ask Marco a few questions. And my purpose in this is to demonstrate, not just explain, to show, just not tell, how this mindset can work. So first of all, I'd like you to step into the realm of all possibilities. So in this realm, everything and anything is possible simply by your say-so. If you wish it, it is law. And in this realm, as your first act of sovereignty, declare and to know that anything that's in here is by your explicit say-so. And any time you want to dismiss anything, phew, you can dismiss it with a flick of a finger, a twink of an eye, with no consequence. In this realm of pure imagination, anything and everything is possible. Do you have a sense of that?
Mm-hmm.
Great. So let's give imagine in your hand a wand like Harry Potter. And imagine that as we look into the future, there are myriad, thousands, tens of thousands, millions of future possibilities. So there's not just one future, there are millions of futures. In fact, more than we could probably count. Do you have that sense? So out of that, what I'd like you to do is to sort for the one future that is viscerally most satisfying, most thrilling, most deeply rewarding. Do you have a sense of that?
Mm-hmm.
Now, as though it were a rug hanging on the wall, let's pull it down here.
All right.
Okay. So, join me. Let's step into this world. This is the rug, if you will, the reality of a most thrilling, most satisfying, most deeply rewarding future. So, how does this feel so far?
This feels pretty great. I like it.
So, where in your body does it show up?
Maybe somewhere up here.
Mm-hmm. And is there any kind of emotion or mood associated with this?
It's maybe happiness and feeling fulfilled.
Great. So there are three epic desires to every man and woman and child alive. We pursue joy, happiness, and aliveness. Joy is the sense of, I have a sense of being connected to the universal. I have a sense of being here, related to everything. It's a sense of context. Happiness. Happiness is that experience of being connected, of being related, not just of belonging, but a sense of, oh, I love what we co-create. I love how you and I come together. And a third thing arises that was unimaginable. And the sense of aliveness is the visceral, energetic sense of being alive, of the pleasure of being in a body and of being able to look into the sky and to see the utter beauty of being alive. These are, in fact, universal themes. However, I want to remove them from the bureaucratic function of state, and I want to now claim them as our personal, individual right, transcendent of state. State is a concept that is perhaps a necessary illusion. But in this future that we are creating, in the future where this is 1,000 times, 10,000 times, 100,000 times faster and cheaper, as software eats the world, as the cloud consumes jobs, as the fundamental nature of how we add value changes in ways that are unimaginable, the notion of a state becomes less and less relevant. And more importantly, the notion of a sovereign individual who makes choices becomes more central to a life well lived. Now, this is a radical idea. I grant you that. It's no more radical an idea than love your neighbor 2,000 years ago. So one of the practices that I have is I call it career pivots for corporate refugees. We are all in this room, whether you acknowledge it or not, are or will soon be a corporate refugee. And what I mean by that, you will find yourself soon, if not already, in an industry that has been disrupted, a career that has truncated, with no job options in your current selected career. You are a refugee. You must immigrate to a new country and pick up just with what you can carry and start anew. Now, we might be of the age where we have a hope of achieving retirement. Okay, fine. For your children, they live with the daunting prospect of being corporate refugees in the next 5 to 10 years. So as I've done these career audits, one of the things I discover is that people first start off in their career in their teens or 20s in an operating context called me. Things are done to me. I have a job, they're done to me. And then usually as I get annoyed, as I get angry, as I start to get more conscious and deliberate about what I want, I move into a space called I. I want this. I want that. I want to pursue these goals. I want to have these experiences. We start driving. We start imprinting our ego upon the world. Good. That's how these buildings got built. There was someone around here that says, let there be, and I want. Fabulous. And then as we begin to understand the limitations of I, as we begin to understand the loneliness of I, we discover that upon reflection, the really great accomplishments in our life were a collaboration that came out of a we. Now, it's the we like on a soccer team. On a soccer team, there might be people on the team that you don't like. In fact, you consider them real jerks. But they are a great striker, or they're a great goalie. So when you walk onto the pitch, you submit your ego to the needs of the team. You become a we. And we get things done that we as individuals could not accomplish. Great. But then comes the requirement for leadership. And this is one of the things that distinguishes a good manager from a good leader. A good manager understands we, of getting everyone on board, moving in the same direction, with clarity in terms of what to do. But a great leader operates from something else. A great leader operates from us. And this is one of the harder lessons I have when I coach and mentor CEOs of startups. To operate from an us basically means that if you did something that was not good for the company, I put away the sword of criticism and I go, he did that because I set him up. That's my responsibility. So if he did something that was not good for the company, it's because I didn't give him the tools, the support. I didn't structure the environment so that he succeeded. It's my accountability. There's no such thing as you're wrong. Leaders do not do you're wrong. They do, okay, what can I do next time to preempt, to have him win here? So ultimately, that kind of describes, if you will, the path through careers of moving from a me, an I, through we, to an us. So I submit there is, in fact, a sense of self, a sense of dignity, a sense of honor in us. But it does require that you give up some of your history. It does require that you give up some of your bullshit. It does require that you give up many of your resentments and regrets. And that's the price, that's the cost, that's the tax of seeing things that hide in plain sight. The thing that makes us stupid, the thing that fills us with stupor, the thing that makes us blind to the wonderful opportunities are essentially resentments and regrets, experiences of thwarted communications and undelivered, unfulfilled expectations, thwarted intentions and undelivered communications. So our ability to see the future and to make it happen and to live it really comes back to our ability to forgive. Now, this is good news and bad news. The good news is we're clear about what's required. The bad news is I'm not very good at it.
I have a question. Do you think that Steve Jobs, as he's showing the iPhone, is an us person?
Yeah. So let me share a story about Steve Jobs. So this was in Palo Alto, 1978. And I'm a junior account executive on the Apple computer account. And we're having a meeting about how to position the Apple III computer relative to the Apple II. And this meeting is Steve Jobs and his entourage, and Regis McKenna and his entourage, and I'm there. And they start talking about how we're going to position, how we're going to communicate how the Apple III is unique relative to the Apple II. And some Bob Delaney starts off, and he goes, mm-hmm. And then somebody on the Apple team says, blah, blah, blah. And the sideways starts to drift sideways into nonsense. And one of the things about Steve is that he had zero tolerance for sloppy thinking. Just zero tolerance for bullshit. Incomplete, sloppy thinking. Now, for those people like Regis McKenna or Johnny Ivey, he's never got upset with them. You talk to these guys. You say, Steve has always treated me, he's always been very civil. Why? Because they're all A-team players. But if you're a C-team player, prepare to have your ass singed. So here he was, we were talking, and he says, I'll tell you what our positioning is. Now, he cussed a lot. And he said, if we were to go out and interview all 4 million of our customers and were to ask, what's the one thing you love about your Apple? And you were to distill those 4 million comments down to one phrase, that is our positioning. So Steve really understood, embodied in the sense of what a computer in a human's life can and should be, and he was just intolerant of sloppy thinking and bad design. It pissed him off to no end that we put such crap in the world like Windows. It just galled his ass to no end because at some level in this space of us, and it wasn't just us in the developed world, it was truly an interconnectedness at the level of humanity that he had a burning, visceral, undeniable, uncompromisable sense of what it can, should, and must be, and was simply intolerant of anything short of that. That's my experience of Steve. So, Marco, let me ask you a couple questions. So, before you started off on your own as a consultant, did you work for a company?
Yes, I did.
Great. What did you do? What was one of the jobs that you did there?
I was essentially a client manager managing other big brands for the company, keeping them happy.
Great. What's one thing you hated about that job?
That I was responsible, essentially, or hold accountable for anything that we messed up.
And what about that did you really not like?
Well, that essentially I had to explain myself what happened with the company. The company was pretty big, called Cisco. So I was not really able to be accountable for all 50,000 employees.
So I might then infer that you have a core value for telling the truth.
Mm-hmm.
You have a core value for delivering what it is that you promised.
Mm-hmm.
You have a core value for representing a company that is honest and sincere about delivering what they promised.
Mm-hmm.
And so when the company broke its promises, it pissed you off.
Sure, yeah.
Great. So it's important to know that wherever Marco goes, he has to tell the truth. He has to be sincere. He has to deliver what he promises. So as a function of that, what did you conclude? That you're probably unemployable.
That's maybe the end result of that, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Great. So what did we just learn there? We learn that we have core values, that when they get violated, we get pissed. And the more pissed we get, the more core values that were violated in that incident. And so what he did is he put himself into a situation where those values get violated much less frequently. He works for himself. He makes promises that he knows that he's going to keep. He keeps those promises that he made. He delivers what he promised.
Always.
Yes, always.
So, gets me into trouble.
So when you were in that job, what was one thing that you loved?
Not being on my own, feeling part of a bigger group that could do more things quicker.
Great. So aspirationally, one of the things that you still seek is the sense of camaraderie, of a team committing to and delivering promises. So what lies ahead of you, what you're then now open to, is how can I maintain my personal integrity while being a member of a team? So this means that you'll need to select partners that share with you these core values. So what's one thing that you learned when you were working at Cisco?
Try to be more in control of things that are happening around you.
Less me, more I. And that there are variables that are always out of beyond your control, but it's incumbent for you to learn to reduce those variables, to expand your space of accountability so that you really are not just accountable, but control them. Great. So now as we start to think about a career where Marco might be, remember this sense of in the future? So here we are. You have a core value around sincerity, of trust, of making promises and keeping them. You have a core value, an aspirational value, around doing that with other people who share this with you. You have another core value called, it's not just enough to do what I do, but I must continue to grow, to expand what I'm accountable for. So now, in this realm of all possibilities, where anything is possible, simply by your say-so, imagine you are now in a situation where all of those are now manifest. Do you have a sense of that? Mm-hmm. Now, you said you had that sense of happiness, and you had a sense of perhaps delighted anticipation of, oh, I can't wait, what's next, right? So now, here you are in 2014. Join me over here, and now we are in 2017 experiencing that reality.
All right.
What would you tell Marco in 2014? What's the one thing that would help Marco of 2014 remember how to get here?
Always look forward to the future and always believe in a better place or you will get to.
Yeah. So what Marco just shared is the secret of how we navigate myriad possibilities, which is to say, in our moment, we say, how much happiness, joy, and aliveness do I want to experience? And then half the world assemble around that mood. Now, in German, there's a wonderful expression. I don't speak German, but there's an expression in German about putting the saddle onto the horse from the backside forward.
Das Pferd von hinten aufzäumen.
So this is now my interpretation of that. We stand in the future that we want, and more specifically, the mood, the visceral sense of being alive, the mood of what that manifest future feels like, and then demanding that the world serve up circumstances that validates that stand. That's the way, that's the only way that I've figured out so far to plan for the myriad endless possibilities. Thank you, Marco. I have one conclusion. I started off with saying, how do we see what hides in plain sight? I suggest that it is a mindset. It's a mindset of understanding that we live in miraculous times, of myriad possibilities, and that the only way to navigate these myriad possibilities is to take a stand and have the world assemble around that stand. Now, in conclusion, there's a science fiction author by the name of William Gibson. He's famous for these cyberpunk novels, Neuromancer, and Mona Lisa Overdrive, and things like this. And there's this one aphorism that perfectly sums my talk today. The future has arrived. Unfortunately, it's unevenly distributed. Some of us are there. Some of us are getting there. And some of us will never get there. Some of us get it. Some of us want to get it. And some of us simply won't. On the basis of that, I turn it over to you.
Michael, thank you so much.